Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hello, James Holland here on the We Have Ways of Making You Talk podcast. Now, I've left Al back in England and I'm in the United States. And this is a conversation I had when I was at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. And an extraordinary place that is too. If you're ever over there, I really do urge you to go and visit it. But while I was there at the annual conference, I hooked up with an old friend of mine, Alex Ritchie, Dr. Alex Ritchie, I should say. Now, she's a Canadian historian, but actually she's married to a Pole and she lives in Warsaw and teaches there as well. And the family story she's inherited is just incredible. And although it's a little bit longer than usual, I have to say, for the whole hour we were talking, I was sat there completely transfixed. It is just the most extraordinary story. I have to warn you, some of it is a little bit harrowing, but I really do hope you find this just every bit as utterly fascinating as I did. I'm in New Orleans, and one of the great things about coming here is there's lots of old friends, and a particularly good old friend is Alex Ritchie.
Hello.
And Alex, here you are. And you have a very interesting life because you are Canadian, born
yes.
and bred.
I am.
But you now live just outside Warsaw.
Yes.
And you teach in Poland.
Yes, I do.
And you're married to a Pole who is incredibly eminent and prominent in Poland. And his your father-in-law was one of the great war heroes. Polish war hero.
Well, I don't know that he's so much a war hero. I think first of all, his name is Władysław Bartoszewski, and what made him really interesting is not so much that he was a war hero in the military sense, but what he did was he was an 18-year-old young guy, grew up in a kind of a normal, you know, sort of, his dad was the head of the Polish, newly formed Polish bank. So this was this patriotic moment, you know, when the Poles in Poland had been recreated in 1918, and, you know, wow, new country and everything mm-hmm. else. And when I first went to Poland, and I was there on the 11th of November, because my Canadian British family are military, it was always a somber, miserable, terribly, you know, very thoughtful day. And I couldn't get over it when, you know, I put my little red poppy on and went outside in Poland, and all of a sudden, wow, you know, the streets are covered with people jumping up and down and doing
really? That's
trumpets
amazing.
And stuff. And said, what is going on? And because for them, it's the recreation of the Polish state after 123 years. So,
of course.
So he becomes part of that generation that's born into that newly created Poland. They call themselves the Columbus generation because they're like finding the new path after all these decades and decades of being under Russian, Prussian, and Austrian rule. So they're finding this new way. They adore their new country, the newly created country. They're not going to give it up. That's why all the Warsaw Uprising stuff happens, because they're so patriotic, so adamant about keeping it. He's part of that generation. 18 years old, finishes school that spring, is going to start university in the fall, 1st of September. Of course, Hitler starts the war. And what we don't really realize, I think, in the West is how quick and how sudden the attack on Poland was. And Hitler always hated Warsaw. So he starts bombing the smithereens under von Richthofen from the very beginning. And so, you know, you're in your apartment, or, you know, it's a very elegant life. People now think of Warsaw as the sort of behind the Iron Curtain, kind of drab and dreary. But back in the 20s, it was very elegant.
It was a very beautiful city, wasn't it?
Yeah, just like, you know, Prague or Vienna. I mean, it was very much one of those places, maybe not as glamorous as those, but still, it was an amazing place. And so,
lots of lovely architecture and buildings and parks and all the rest of it.
It was
townhouses, you know, and villas and things.
Absolutely, that sort of classic Central European
town
with lots of, you know, the typical architecture.
Well, you got a taste of it from going to Krakow, which wasn't particularly bomb.
Yeah, although Krakow is different again, because Krakow is much, much older. So that really is a Renaissance medieval town, whereas I would say more like sort of the modern parts of 20s parts of Vienna. Budapest maybe would be the more equivalent. But anyway, you get the idea. It was a very elegant, lovely life. And here he is, the sort of son of a banker and all this kind of thing. And all of a sudden, bang, you know, bombs start falling. And his father realizes the Germans are coming. And in their family, like many, many, many people I've talked to, they think, Well, you know, it's better than the Russians. You know, like the Germans last time around in Warsaw weren't so bad. You know, they, you know, okay, it was occupying and everything else, but they were pretty good, and they sort of let Piłsudski recreate Poland. So, okay, well, you know, they're a pretty civilized bunch. So we're not really going to be too worried about it. But then the bombings keep going, and you know, the invasion in Poland gets sort of more and more unpleasant, and then finally Hitler wins. But the bombing of Warsaw is actually very, very intense, even at the very beginning. And there's a lot of evidence to show that Hitler already had in his mind this Generalplan Ost idea that you're going to really wipe out these big cities of Central and Eastern Europe and replace them with kind of German architecture, German, you know, culture and everything mm-hmm. else. And you kill all the Jews, you get rid of all the Slavs, and you recreate these fake German cities in these places. And this was one of the ideas. So clearly Hitler was...
So there's a whole ideological thing going on.
Already. And of course the Poles have no idea about this. Yet. They just think, well, the Germans are kind of going through, but, you know, it's not going to be that bad. And so Vladek's dad, you know, the older Vladek, both have the same name, Vladislav, says, well, I think you should be a stretcher bearer for the Red Cross. At least you can be helpful. So he signs up with the Red Cross, starts getting bodies out of the rubble, which is, you know, pretty badly bombed. About 20% of buildings are damaged or destroyed in the first few weeks of the bombing in mm-hmm. Warsaw 1939. People don't realize it was quite bad. Anyway, so he's registered. The reason that's important is that he's registered with the Red Cross then. So another thing happens. Of course, the Germans come in. Hitler does his victory parade in down through the middle streets of Warsaw. No Poles are allowed to go. There's nobody around. They check out all the buildings, and you're not allowed to be there. And Hitler at the last minute changes the route because he's already afraid of mm-hmm. assassination attempts. Anyway, a few weeks later, the Germans start this idea of creating this camp at Auschwitz. And the reason for Auschwitz at the very beginning is the creation of a camp for Polish intellectuals. The Polish sort of, they want to decapitate the yeah. head of Polish society. It's not originally a camp for Jews. It becomes that later, and of course very much more murderous. And so he's at home, and all of a sudden there's a roundup in this little district, where I live now in Warsaw, and all men between age 16 and 60 are forced out of their houses or their apartments, rounded up in this central square, Platz Wilsona, Wilson Place, named after President Wilson.
God, it's incredible, isn't it? Can you just imagine that happening now?
Yeah, no, it's mind-boggling.
All these families just being ripped to pieces.
Yeah, ripped to pieces. Nobody knew what was happening because, as I said, they sort of thought the Germans weren't going to be that bad yet. They didn't get it. And so they take him to with this group of men. And by the way, Witold Pilecki, who's very famous now, there's a book about him. Who's, you know, got mm-hmm. himself into Auschwitz. This is the same transport to Auschwitz, second transport from Warsaw to Auschwitz. Anyway, so he gets on this.
And Auschwitz is already an army barracks.
Polish army barracks. Well, it started earlier as an Austrian army barracks in 19th century. So when you go there, and this is a lot of people get confused, it doesn't look, you know, so bad. These original, you know, you see the Arbeitmachtfrei sign, and then you go in, and there are these sort of brick buildings, and you think, well, you know, it doesn't look that bad. Well, of course, the way in which people were treated there is what makes it so absolutely appalling.
Yeah, and of course, the bit that everyone envisaged in their mind is Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is the second camp.
Of course. But it was pretty horrific in Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. So there's this young guy, 18 years old, no idea what's going on, in this group of guys. They're sent to a horse stables in the center of Warsaw, in the center park in Warsaw, Wajenki Park. And they're forced to lie on the ground for 2 days, and then they're taken to, you know, the typical goods freight wagons, mm-hmm. and then they don't know where they're going, no idea, you know, nothing to eat. The whole, you know, this is, the Germans have now perfected this. They've been running camps from Dachau and so on, quite from right the beginning of their reign. So
keeping people discombobulated and kind of in the dark, that's all part of it.
It's all part of it. It's all very, very carefully thought out, and they perfect it, of course, as things go along. So
God, it's just too sinister for words.
It's horrific. I mean, it's just hard to get your head around it. So then, you know, typical, they get there at night after a journey of a day and a half. They get there at night, you know, doors open, rouse, with reflector lights in their eyes. They can't see. People break their ankles because they're being shoved off down, you know, it's really quite high up if you see those cars. It's not like a little mm-hmm. sort of step down.
And yeah, 3 or 4 feet, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, you're jumping in the dark onto mm-hmm. uneven ground. And he said, you know, dogs biting, trying to rip your ankles and rip your clothes off and stuff. Just horrific.
I mean,
this is classic entry to Auschwitz and to the other camps. This is the Germans perfect this, and they use it the whole time in the war, which is awful. Just even these things are just so horrific. Pushed into the camp, same drill for everybody, and we, you know, you've heard this many, many times, but this actually just happens to him. You know, whole body is shaved, hair, but all pubic hair, everything else, horrible, with these kind of dull razors that cut your skin, and then you get some horrible disinfectant on you, and you're supposed to have a stripy uniform, which happens later, but in his case, they hadn't enough stripy uniforms, so he got an old Wehrmacht uniform, clearly some with the epaulets and stuff pulled off. Clearly some guy died in it, because there's a big, huge splodge of blood on it, so, you know, this is already not exactly the most pleasant thing. And wooden clogs, and, you know, it's going into September, it's going to go into the winter, and that's all you get. He and his colleagues who tried to, for example, cut paper cement bags to shove down their clothes to get a bit of insulation would just be beaten to a pulp. You know, this is not even that. You know, you're verdammt, you know, you're stealing property from the Germans because you're trying to get some paper to pad your...
God, it's unimaginable, isn't it?
It is. It's just beyond belief. And the thing about going to Auschwitz now, and I take my groups from the World War II Museum groups through Auschwitz, and I see the difference between going with a kind of tour guide when you're going with thousands of people, almost like a sort of sausage machine. You go from one building to another building, and you're sort of trundling along behind other people, and it's very sanitized and so on. When I went there with him, I had a totally different experience, because he would say, you know, you don't get it just by looking around now, even though they've tried to preserve the terrain as it was.
But what does he think going back there? I mean, when he was there, what was...
Well, he became the head of the International Auschwitz Committee, and he was the founder of this because he wanted to preserve Auschwitz, and there was, you know, the people didn't know what to do.
The warning from history.
Exactly. And you know, even though he was, first of all, concentrated on Auschwitz I and Birkenau, of course, there's the whole terrain it's a huge complex. But so what he would talk about was, even at the very beginning, just the sheer brutality of the SS guards and the capos. So again, the Germans had created the capo system, where they started with criminals from Dachau who were brought to Auschwitz, and they were rewarded. The more brutal they were to the new coming prisoners, the more they were rewarded. So if you beat somebody to death...
How do you survive in that?
Well, it was interesting, because he talked about...
How much is luck, do you think?
Oh, huge amount, of course, is luck. But he said, you know, the very beginning, the very first day, you're forced in Auschwitz, you were forced to stand in these rows at this roll call. And you had to stand there in you know, upright. And he said the very first day they made you stand for sort of 2 hours. You can imagine, you're cold, you've no idea what's going on. And sometimes they had roll calls that went on for 12 or 16 hours, and you weren't allowed to move. If you crumpled, you were beaten to death if you fell down. And so what happened in this very, very first roll call, and he realized mentally, psychologically...
So roll calls could last 16 hours?
They could. They didn't often, but from time to time, if a prisoner went missing... This was also an attempt to prevent escapes, to prevent prisoners from misbehaving. So they knew that the whole camp would be punished, and that some people would die if you tried to escape. So in this very first roll call, he's standing there, you know... Like 5 minutes ago, he was living a normal life. He just
they're drinking wine, having nice food with their family.
Yeah, exactly. And all of a sudden, he recognizes a lot of people because they're neighborhood people. I mean, I live near Plattsville, so I see people all the time. And he was two rows behind an old schoolmaster, an old school teacher who he knew. He never had him personally as a teacher. And this old guy just couldn't stand. And he fell down, and the guards came in and beat him to death. And it became commonplace for him. It became absolutely normal life. But what he said at that moment is that there were thousands of men, because they were all men at that point. Later, women came to the camp. But at that point, there were all men standing in rows, absolutely hating the guards, hating what was happening to them. And yet they realized from that very beginning moment that they couldn't do anything. And he felt such shame, total disgrace. You know, how can we just stand here? And it's a sort of a beginnings of an explanation for me of that age-old question: well, why didn't the Jews rise up? Why did people follow? Why did they? And he examined himself psychologically so often, because he was a very energetic guy, and a very, you know, a doer, you know, very, very much the sort of person who'd say, "I'm not standing for this," you know. And yet he said this psychological somehow shift that happened when you became a prisoner like that. And I imagine this is very much the same experience that actually anybody has if you're going into like a high security prison. Yep. If you you're put in a uniform, your head's shaved, you're treated by all sorts of rules that you don't understand. But he said that you just had to switch your mind, and the it may be a cliche, sound like a cliche, but it really happened to him that the commandant stood in front of the group of newcomers and said, and pointed to the chimney and said, the only way you're getting out of here is through that chimney. And he said it was a psychological breakdown he'd never experienced in his life. And he wasn't a nightmare-y sort of person, and he wasn't a sort of miserable, you know, suffering from this overtly sort of person, but he said that he did have nightmares about that moment when he was in Auschwitz and knew that he had entered a world where all the norms of society were flipped on their head. It had gone. And not even like a prison where you could sort of understand it, just gone. In other words, the more, I don't know, decently you behaved, the more noble you were, or the more, you know, whatever it was. Counted for nothing, in fact, it counted against you. And I asked him once, I remember, because he was for a very short time forced to pull one of these huge concrete rollers with a handle, you know, that, mm-hmm. to sort of flatten out the earth. They didn't flatten out the earth, but he said that the even at the very beginning, the people who were being singled out then were Jews and priests. And that the SS guys, the sort of torment that they would do, they made them pull these rollers around, doing nothing, you know, not flattening out any earth or whatever.
It's just going to be waste of
time. It's just a waste of time, like, you know. And then these SS guys would jump on the iron bar, you know, and then beat the people who were trying to pull the rollers just to make it heavier. And then the capos would have games, like, could you kill somebody with one blow of an iron bar to the kidneys, or did it take you two? And if it took you two, you lost the game, you know, and this kind of thing. It just torment, just killing and maiming.
But if you're
fun.
If you're that capo, if you're that guard, I mean, how do you get to that point?
I think it became, and we see it very often in the Nazi system and also in the Soviet system and elsewhere in the world. Actually, any of these totalitarian and brutalist systems or closed environments, prisons or whatever, there have been many, many examples since that if you offer a system of rewards, which is what the Nazis exactly did, they get these criminals in from Dachau or whatever, call them capos, give them a different uniform, put them in charge of these people and say, the more brutal you are, the more you're going to be rewarded with more food or more freedoms or whatever. And if you're not, if we see you sneaking food to the prisoners, or if you're nice to them or whatever, you're getting right back in line with them. And the thing is that and most of these capos were also killed along the way. And of course, once you're talking about Birkenau, you're talking about a whole different system where you have, I mean, it happened in Auschwitz 1 too, where you have people who are, for example, sorting the clothes, sorting the valuables from the prisoners who've been taken, brought into the camp. And they get that job for...
Sonderkommando
gets the job for 5 months and then they're killed and then you get a rotation because you don't want anybody getting... you know, living too long in the system. So it just became a system of absolute horror, complete horror. And as I said, going through the camp with him, when he would say, you know, that's a place where, you know, people were hung up by their wrists were shackled together and they were hung up on an iron bar and their shoulders broken and then, you know, for 2 days and then they died. Or this is a place where, you know, you had to march past an orchestra playing friendly, jolly marching tunes on your way both back in out to go to work outside and then back in carrying the bodies of those people who died and he said starvation was just killing by starvation and work and he said you could tell when somebody was going to die. They became what they called Muzelmen, which is I don't know why they call them that, but they became, you know, sort of waxy faced and had a kind of strange look in their eyes and walked around kind of like zombies. And he said you just see that look on somebody, you just know that's it. They're not going to live for more than a day or maybe two. And that was it. And this is just very much a part of the whole system of terror and the camp structure that was built up deliberately by the Nazis from the very beginning.
And how much does that go back to Hitler himself? And how much is that Himmler and people below Himmler?
It's very much thought out. I mean, Hitler approves of all of this stuff. But the people who really come up with this system are Himmler and people like Heydrich and Eichmann. And then, you know, there's the remnants of the SA who really had a lot of fun beating people up and so on. There's this whole culture of violence that begins even before Hitler even thinks about getting into
the street thugs and all
the street fights all set up, you know, chains and iron bars against the communists in Red Wedding or whatever in Berlin. I mean, this was part of the violence that the Nazis used, which is in turn a remnant of the First World War violence, which you've got all, you know, this amazing society in Imperial Berlin or Imperial Germany with the Kaiser strutting around in his very, very strict formal system. Berlin, the most hugest industrial society on the continent, hugely wealthy, very, very important place. And all of a sudden, it goes from this pompous, sparkly, to absolute rock bottom, and then being told you're responsible for the war, having all these guys come back who are homeless, nothing to do. They've been on the front. They're brutalized because being on a place like the Western Front and the Eastern Front, you don't.
And then the Nazis come along and say, "Be a street fighter."
And exactly. Either be a street fighter or be a Stahlhelm guy, and you can go beat up Poles or Czechs or whatever. Name the task. And this is the thing. So it's this violence, also violence of the Bolshevik Revolution, which of course Hitler uses to make people frightened once he takes power. But he also learns a lot from Bolshevik violence. I mean, that's another thing, is that they learn from each other, and they learn how to create a system where violence is underpinning everything. And it does to the very end, no matter how Hitler dresses himself up. 1933 at Potsdam Day, when he's dressed up in his top hat and tails and bows before Hindenburg and is all looking like a sort of upper middle class gentleman or whatever. Underpinning all of it is violence. It just is that kind of system. And so you can dress it up, you can make it look nice, which Goebbels very carefully did. When he was giving a speech to certain districts of Berlin, he would talk about how they wanted to bring law and order or whatever, but 5 hours later he'd be making a speech in Red Wedding and they'd be beating up communists with iron bars and chains. So it was all so carefully planned and so carefully done. And this is one of the things that...
But it's the harnessing of willing people. I mean, this is what I find so completely upsetting when I see people spouting their absolute bile on Twitter or Facebook or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
I mean, people say things which are just so completely unacceptable.
Absolutely.
And you're getting this hint, you're just getting this little vision of what could happen.
Yeah, exactly.
You go from sort of really sort of brutal, horrible words to actual physical brutality.
Yeah.
And the stepping stone is not great.
Oh, you're so right. This is exactly
And that's
that.
What I find what's so worrying about today's world. Here we are in the United States. I mean, what Trump is doing is breaking down precedent. And once you've broken down precedent, once you've taken down sort of the normal standards of Western democratic statesmanship, it's really hard to rebuild it again.
It's very hard to get it back.
We're sort of okay in the UK, despite the divisions of Brexit.
Yeah.
But it has polarized society.
Yeah.
And you can see how things descend.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that I always, people often ask me, but I spent my life studying this stuff, and people often say, well, what about the Holocaust, the camps, the Auschwitz, terrible, terrible. And I always say, no, the game's over already when you say to a Jewish kid that you're not allowed to have a pet because you're Jewish, or you can't sit on a park bench. You're done.
Well, I've just been looking at this amazing home films, this archive that's been, I think it's been there for quite a while, but it's been sort of just discovered in inverted commas.
Yeah.
And so the BBC are doing a series about it, and they've got all this kind of home movies. Germans are really into that. And so I had to sit through a whole load of this stuff the other day and kind of sort of comment on it and say, what's going on? Why is this there? What was really shocking about it was you saw in April 1933 some footage of Jews being persecuted. And they're just being pushed around in the street.
Yeah.
They're kind of daubing across to
it's
David.
All, it's
on
all
the,
over. It's game over.
It is.
Right there.
It absolutely is. But no one sort of, no one is at this point kind of sending Jews off to camps or anything like that. But a few minutes later, I was watching a different set of footage, which is a kind of sort of a bunch of films put together from the Eastern Front, and that was just gobsmacking because this was people being strung up. You're watching them being hanged.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like watching something out of the sort of
Is that the Ukrainian doctor's footage, the one that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
My God. Yeah. And then the people being shot in the back of the head, and you see the people sort of being led to it, and they kneel down, and they're shot in the head, and they're kicked. They're just literally pushed into
it. That's what it comes to.
It is absolutely horrific. I can't even begin to tell you how profoundly upsetting I found the whole thing. But because of... And I'm not saying we're just about to descend into the abyss or anything like that, but what you see... Yeah. Is the stepping stones are
absolutely
not.
And the thing is that, as you say, 1933, well, what happens? The Reichstag fire. Hitler puts in the Enabling Act. First thing he does is start murdering, members of parliament, members of the Reichstag, for example. There's a really lovely, great memorial just outside the Reichstag in Berlin, with sort of shards of stone with the names of all of the murdered members of the Reichstag. And there are some hundred and something of them. They were just murdered in their homes or whatever. Oh. These are the sort of representatives of government. Okay, they were social democrats. Okay, they were communists or whatever. Oh my goodness, let's murder them. You know, once you're doing that, you're done.
Yeah.
And okay, I was certainly not a great fan of the Berlin or the German Communist Party, which wanted to overthrow Weimar too and create a Bolshevik society. Not my cup of tea either, because I hate radicalism on either side. But you don't go just murdering these people because you don't like them very much. The whole thing is completely crazy. And you're absolutely right. What's happening in our society with Twitter and this absolute rudeness. I mean, you wouldn't sit in front of somebody you didn't like very much and say, you know, fill in the blank what you've just read on Twitter. It's just simply unbelievable. And it's so unacceptable. And it's the erosion of norms. So people might have been thinking these horrible thoughts all along, but you just learn that you can think them in your head and you can go home and say them to your cat or something, but you know, you don't act on them. You've got to learn to control yourself. You probably learned whatever it is I don't like, fill in the blank. You got to probably go home and work on yourself, figure out what it is in your childhood that made you think that way. But this is not what happened. What happened instead was Hitler and the Nazis gave vent to this, to the worst tendencies in all of us. And if you tell
they made acceptable the kind of, you know, yes, man's basis thoughts. Yeah. I mean, that's the point.
And I don't believe, having again interviewed hundreds of people, that Germans, you know, went into 1933, all of them rabid anti-Semites who were keen to set up Treblinka. But if you give permission, and that's the scapegoat, and you tell them every single day, and you work on it, whatever, and then you do Kristallnacht. Even Kristallnacht, there was, you know, as you well know, of course, there were SIPO reports, so the Secret Service reports, that the Gestapo went around and listened to the Germans' reactions to all of these things. They did this and found out that the euthanasia program was very unpopular. So they kind of, well, they didn't really stop it, but they hid it away. And Archbishop Galen and all these other people who spoke up against it were also important. But the Kristallnacht as well. There were a lot of people who, I'm not so sure I like the fact that people are smashing the shops. You know, some people didn't like it because it was messy. Some people didn't like it because it was violent. Some people didn't like it because their friend, you know, who was a doctor down the road who was Jewish, his shop was smashed and he was, you know, beaten up. And so there was a personal contact as well. And then some people were gung-ho and thought it was great and we're going to get rid of the Jews from German society. But there was still a kind of a whole range of reactions that all is documented in these Gestapo secret reports. And so that's the funny thing. It wasn't like, oh, yes, they're all like zombies. People still don't have choice. You could make choices. And another thing I find...
Well, there's also that amazing book that Gittes Rennie does on Franz Engel. And you just see that constantly. I mean, he doesn't start off bad.
Yeah.
He just keeps meeting forks in the road and keeps taking the wrong one. And every time he takes the wrong road, it just gets him deeper and deeper and deeper and he can't get out and he takes the carrot option.
Exactly. It's the Kurt Waldheim thing, you know, who was the head of the United Nations years and years ago. And he, they discovered then when he was in the SS, when it was in Greece, that he was with a small unit and two of the guys refused to shoot partisans and prisoners. And he was quite happy to participate in one way or another. I'm not sure if he was actually guilty of a war crime, but he was at least quite gung-ho, and it was possible even within the, you know, of a unit, you could make one choice or another choice.
At the very best, he lacked moral courage.
Yeah, exactly. And you see it even in the, you know, the Christopher Browning's fantastic work on the Ordinary Men, where he says, you know, the Germans take this group of ordinary Hamburg policemen who are perfectly normal family guys and a little bit too old to be in the Wehrmacht and stuff, brings them over and says, well, we've got a really unpleasant task. We've got to kind of shoot a village of people. But if you don't want to do it, you don't have to. And some people say, okay, I'm not going to do it. You know, and then the peer pressure starts to work at them and they start to say, well, I guess we better partake. But there were all, and then he divides the I mean, it's a very broad strokes thing, but he divides this group after the end of his research into three main categories. Those people who were always reluctant, who remained on the margins, who never really participated. They sometimes had to, because if you didn't, you yourself would either get shot or punished. Those in the middle who were kind of indifferent, who did it because you do it. And then those who really learned to love killing, really enjoyed killing, and got a great pleasure.
It's an amazing book, isn't it? I mean, it's absolutely horrifying. I mean, it's, it, yeah. it,
Yeah, great, great piece of work. And there are more and more of these things now coming out. And what I think is fantastically interesting is to show, is to see the psychology of people. So I would imagine in any society, and this is why I hate groups of people or countries that say, oh, well, we wouldn't be like that. It's like, well, yeah, maybe most people wouldn't be, but there's always going to be the people who are the Archbishop Galens who actually speak out, or the resistors. And then there's going to be those people who really quite love doing this.
Yeah.
It gives them power, they get a uniform, or they get a gown, or they get whatever.
No one's exempt from this.
Nobody.
I mean, it would happen in Britain. Absolutely no doubt about it at all. So what happened to your father-in-law? I mean, he's on the first draft.
Yeah, he gets
and yet he obviously survives. I mean, that's an amazing story.
Very unusual in Auschwitz. About 500 people were released from Auschwitz, and he was young and hadn't been charged with anything. We to this day aren't sure if there was some deal between his father or his mother and the SS or whatever, but we don't know of anything, and he didn't know of anything. But anyway, he was released. He was released with two other prisoners and sent back on a train to Warsaw.
Well, just to say, one day he just thinks he's going to die.
Yeah.
It's going to be here for eternity, and then suddenly he gets called out.
And he was very, very ill. He almost died. In fact, he remembered being taken.
Well, malnutrition and just overworked.
He got typhus, and he was taken to the which was very common in the camps, and he was taken to this infirmary, which still exists. He pointed out where it was, and there were two doctors arguing over him. He remembered this, to whether or not he should live or die, and the older doctor went, there's no hope, there's absolutely no hope, he's just gone, forget it, let's take
him. Oh my goodness.
And the younger guy said, no, he's really, really young, let's give him a chance. And they, for about 5 or 6 days, he was completely out of it.
Were these German doctors, or were they Polish doctors?
Well, no, they were Polish. They were Polish working in the camp for the Germans, though.
Okay, but they had some compassion.
Yeah, of course they were very compassionate toward the prisoners. These were not Mengele doctors.
Right.
These were people who were hated what they were forced to do, actually. But and it was a very interesting thing. Again, the horror of being even in the infirmary. As he got a little bit better, he got to know some of the. We weren't allowed to talk to each other, but he got to know some of the other prisoners. Well, one of them was one of the greatest economics professors in Central European history, actually, Professor Heidel, who taught in Paris and all sorts of other places. And he was in this infirmary as well. He was one of the professors who'd been rounded up in the infamous roundup of the university professors from Krakow University. And there he was, and he very quietly, would go and speak to him because he was a great hero of his, and he would sort of talk to him about his life and so on. And Heidel thought he was probably going to die, and they were having this secret conversation. All of a sudden, they had signals already, between the prisoners if somebody was coming. SS came out, took him outside in the hallway, and shot him.
Hello, it's James Holland here. While I've got your attention, I hope you won't mind me mentioning a book I wrote called Normandy 44, D-Day and the Battle for France. You may have heard me mention this before, but I hate to say it, Christmas is getting nearer. And if you're thinking of what to buy for those with an interest in history, and especially those fascinated, as Al and I are, by the Second World War, well, perhaps this might be something to consider. This is just a mention, nothing more. I think there's something for everyone in it. Bags of human drama, plenty of easy-to-follow analysis, a bit of myth-busting, pictures, maps, and I hope all put together in a way that makes for a fascinating and fast-paced read. That's the aim, at any rate. And should this be a book that is stirring interest, then it's very easy to buy from Waterstones, Amazon, or any bookshop throughout our great land. Thank you, and happy Christmas.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
My father-in-law wrote a book called My Auschwitz, Moi Auschwitz, it's in Polish, and he dedicated it to Professor Heidel, and wow. He was able to tell his family, it's a very famous family in Poland, what happened to their father or their grandfather now. And this, but this is the sort of brutal, just completely, it's just, you know...
So Vladek gets out of Auschwitz, but he's not going to, I mean... How does he survive the war?
Well, he goes back to Warsaw on this train. He had a very interesting experience because he's so brutalized already. It's a complete, and he gets on this train and the people are very, very sympathetic because Poles understand that there are these camps growing up right. all over the place. So they're sympathetic, but they don't know what to do. And a young girl gives him her sandwiches, like wow. sort of school-type sandwiches.
Yeah.
And he said it was the first kind gesture that he'd experienced, for months and months and months to keep... began to realize...
So how long had he been in there?
He was almost a year, so he was... Wow. And he survives the winter, which is amazing in and of itself, yep. the sorts yep. of things that you go through with no food and no clothing and stuff, which is also why he was so weak and got so ill. Anyway, he gets back to Warsaw. He's 6 months lying in bed in the flat. And at that point, a very close friend of his called Hanka Czaka is this... is trying to recover, recuperate, and his mom and this... mom's taking care of him, and this young girl comes over, and she is in the resistance already, and she writes down his testimony because they don't know what Auschwitz is. It's so right. secret; they didn't right. have a clue what it was. So he writes, he narrates what happened. It's called Auschwitz: Diary of a Prisoner, and it's the first officially recognized eyewitness testimony from Auschwitz. And they sent it to the Polish government in exile in London. They changed the ending to make it look like he died so that they couldn't try and trace him. But otherwise, it's completely accurate. And so this becomes kind of a world, moment when this first document starts to show what's going on in this terrible camp. Of course, it gets way, way worse later. But he was very lucky to survive. When he gets better, he goes to his priest. It's a very famous priest at the Wisitki Church in Warsaw. And he says, I really don't know what to do, how to get over this. And of course, there's no hope of having a job or going to university or anything like that. The priest says, help people who are worse off than you are. And by which he meant the Jews. Vladek comes back to Warsaw and finds there's a wall around the ghetto
yep.
because it wasn't there when he left.
Yep.
And of course, because he grew up in the... Jewish at the edge of the Jewish quarter, because his father lived in the National Bank, and the bank right. is right at the edge of the Jewish quarter. A lot of Jewish friends coming to the house and so on,
yep.
and played in the park with the Jewish kids.
Sure.
So for him, unlike a lot of people in Poland, where there was both with the Jews and the Poles, there was a segregation really,
right.
self-imposed, cultural, religious.
Sure.
But he didn't have that. So for him, the Jews were like, yeah, well,
whatever.
Whatever. Much more like, I'd say, a British or North American upbringing that we take for granted. But in those days, it wasn't the case. And so he realizes, yes, this is exactly what I have to do because the ghetto is getting worse and worse. And he gets in touch with various acquaintances, including Hanka Chuck, who recommends him to the underground. And it's Jan Karski who becomes the great courier who sort of swears him in to the
right.
underground. And he co-founds this organization called Żygota, which is a nonsense name, with a couple of other people to help to try and save the the Jews from the ghetto.
What a guy.
And they get money from the Polish government in exile, but they also get money from American and British organizations that funnel money in through the Polish government in exile, and it's a specific department set up within the government,
right.
Only one in Europe. It's completely unique. And they fly this money and stuff in by the so-called Cicho Ciemne, trained by the SOE. They're called Silent and Unseen. These are Polish guys who are trained by the SOE to parachute into Poland on these secret missions.
And hand over cash.
And hand over cash or information or, you know,
God, it's just amazing, isn't it?
It's incredible. And there's Cicho Ciemne, very famous Cicho Ciemne drop just behind my house. So I always take my...
Tourist. Is this your house in Warsaw? Because you've got no, a house outside,
outside.
Haven't you?
Outside. This is the SS headquarters house, outside. And there's a big, huge forest.
I should just say right here, you just say the SS headquarters house. So you have your place in the country is,
yes,
just outside Warsaw.
Yeah.
And it's a nice pad.
Yeah, nice pad.
But it was a SS headquarters in the war at one point.
It was.
And it got caught up in Operation Bagration, didn't it?
It did. It did, absolutely. It was it was the headquarters to...
Which is, of course, the Russian offensive. Red Army offensive in the summer of 1944.
Yeah, it was huge, huge, successful offensive, which Stalin certainly didn't expect to get to the gates of Warsaw. And this is what also triggers the Warsaw Uprising. So it's a very, very interesting history. But Walter Model's right there,
yes,
with this big counterattack, and the... SS Viking Division and SS Totenkopf are on the property, and led by Herbert Gila.
Yeah.
Herbert Gila leads Viking, and then Totenkopf are joined together just for these maneuvers, and Herbert Gila takes over the house, and that's his headquarters, and he watches some of the battles between the Red Army and Walter Model's forces. Right on the edge of the property, and in fact the village, the next village over, is taken on one day, taken over back and forth 12 times. It's unbelievable.
Oh,
it's just incredible.
So have you got photos of them in the house?
I've got some photos of them in the house, and I've got...
I mean, how does that make you feel?
Them.
I mean, that would just absolutely do my head in.
Well, I didn't know when I got the place. I wanted a nice little place for my kids to be just outside of Warsaw.
Right.
But of course, I was doing work on the uprising, but I'm mostly interested in the battles that took place and caused the uprising. The uprising, of course, I'm interested in too, but I was fascinated by this because one of those... You know, David Glantz talks about these
yeah,
battles of the Eastern Front that are just forgotten about, not known, or whatever. And for all sorts of reasons, and I think the main reason these battles... And there were, you know, 600 tanks destroyed. This is not chicken feed. These are the biggest battles on Polish soil in World War II. You know, even bigger
right
than
on your
39.
Doorstep.
Right on the doorstep.
Where you're taking the dog a walk.
Yeah, we're
that's
taking
where,
the dog for a walk. We're finding all this ordnance and stuff everywhere.
Are you? Do you survive
yes,
that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. All sorts
I've got
of stuff,
to come and see this.
Tank tracks and bits of you know, I mean, helmets and stuff all over the place. I mean, it's amazing.
I mean, what we should do one of these days, we should, you know, Al and I should come over.
Yeah,
invite
absolutely.
Ourselves.
And, yeah, just invite yourselves over.
And you can give us a tour.
Absolutely. I'd love to do that. And I also love
and
to
we
shoot
do Operation Bagration. I think people would be really interested. I'm really interested.
Yeah, I'd love to do it. In fact, one of the tours I'm thinking of doing with the World War II Museum is when we're starting up a northern tour, which is going from Hamburg all the way to the north. And it's based on Peenemünde, especially,
right,
to see Wernher von Braun and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
But we're also going to do, you know, hit lots of the other things up in the north. But the other one we're trying to put together, and it depends a little bit as to whether or not we can get into Belarus easily, start in Minsk and then go
wow.
through to Berlin. So, and you know,
that'd be amazing.
Going to Zeller Heights and all that. So
Zeller Heights are amazing.
Isn't it
I've been
amazing?
There those times. Yeah,
yeah,
all the trenches and stuff. Incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, you can just see how the whole battle kind of
and
out. But hold on a minute. We're going to jump the gun. So what happens to your father-in-law? He survives the whole flipping thing.
He does. And
I mean, that's amazing.
He's involved in Żygota. He survives. And he's denounced many times. In fact, I got in the new World War II Museum in Gdansk, there's one denunciation notice to the Gestapo, which, of course, these are all intercepted by the Polish Home Army. They intercept all his mail going to the... I mean, the Polish Home Army is amazing. They've got like 400,000 guys.
It's pretty sophisticated.
They're very sophisticated. It's a whole underground state, whole underground universities, underground army. It's just incredible.
So just in a different league to literally every other...
Every other one. The only thing that's comparable is perhaps Yugoslavia, but in terms of the fighting arm, but in terms of the whole underground culture and why. The Poles have been living under Austrian, Prussian and Russian rule for 123 years, and they
right.
learn how to do it. So they got this little hiatus of 20
whereas
years.
Whereas France, of course,
they don't know how to do it. So they do their best, but you know, and France is also much more complicated politically because
yes.
it's like Norway or whatever because they're
right.
treated so well, and they also had World War I and all that. Poland, you know, the Germans just go slamming right in. They're not going to, Hitler won't have anything to do with any Poles. There's no SS Galician.
Interesting.
It's just bang. And that's the thing. So there's just no hope of, I mean, I'm sure some Poles would have collaborated if they'd have been given enough incentive or whatever, but there was just no way because Hitler hated them so much. There was just no way. There's just not going to happen. And of course, there was also the quite substantial German Volksdeutsch minority in Poland.
Yes.
And because of places like Bydgoszcz and other towns, quite sizable German minorities. And they did, many of them did collaborate, not all, but many of them did collaborate with the Germans. And so that provided sort of sixth, fifth column, which was very unpleasant as well. And they'd give people away and stuff. But anyway, back to the denunciations, we have three of them. Two were in the Polish National Archive, and one is in the museum in Gdansk, denouncing my father-in-law, saying, you know, this guy's saving Jews, got money, you know, something has to be done. And all three of them are, two are anonymous, and one is from a Polish person, we don't know if it's a man or a woman, who actually signs a name, whether it's real or not, intercepted by the Polish underground before it gets to the Gestapo, and thereafter preserved. So it's absolutely amazing. So, and these are Poles who are denouncing him.
Absolutely amazing.
You know, not Germans.
So he survives.
And he survives this. And another really interesting thing is there's a little museum dedicated to him in Wrocław, because he dedicated his papers and stuff to the big Polish National Archive called Ossa Linnaeum, and so they put a little museum up in his honor, which is lovely. And one of the most amazing things, aside they've got his original Auschwitz papers and photograph and all that kind of stuff there, but one of the most, I don't want to say beautiful, but amazing things is these little teeny tiny kind of pieces of onion skin paper, you know, the little tiny pieces of paper with little tiny receipts of money that were that the Jewish recipients of money, these little tiny things that they weren't supposed to keep. It's called the Felicia Archive. And the woman who was managing this hid them in her back garden, dug a hole and hid them, and so they survived the war. So we have these little tiny mementos, anyway, of the work that Żygota did, giving money, you know, giving, and they also did find apartments. Władysław Szpilman, the pianist, was a great friend of Vladek's dad's. He was one of the zookeeper's wife. He worked together with him. The wife wasn't that important, but it's a good story. But
God, it's just amazing, isn't it? Incredible. I mean, how sort of extraordinary to have sort of married into all that.
Oh yeah, it was my accident.
You know, you're from the west coast of Canada, and suddenly you know where it's all so far removed, and suddenly you're sort of
right in this world. Yeah, amazing. And I mean, I met Vladek at Oxford, and I immediately liked the guy, but I had no idea who Władysław Bartoszewski was. His father, because the communism was still in place, I met him in 1980, first saw him in 1985, we kind of met, the Ralph Darnd of the head of our college introduced us at a kind of drinks party, and we sort of went, and I had no idea. In fact, I thought he was going to be like a communist spy or something, because I was at St. Anthony's College, which is the spy college.
Right.
And the, generally speaking, the rule was that if you were at university in Oxford or Cambridge or one of the other British universities from a communist country, that you were probably some reprobate who was being paid by the communist government. So I immediately was terribly suspicious and thought, oh my God, you know. But Ralph Dahrendorf introduced us, and then I asked around a few friends, Tim Garton Ash and some others, and said, do you know this guy? And they said, well, you know, his dad, you know, in prison for most of the Stalinist period, and you know, Vladek was kicked out of Poland because he was told he couldn't continue his university degree because they were politically unacceptable. So he had family in England who helped him to carry on his education.
So his father-in-law was then in prison by the...
He was in prison for Solidarity. So he was in prison by the Nazis at Auschwitz, and then he was imprisoned in 7 years in Stalinist prison, and then he was imprisoned Solidarity under martial law. So 1981, martial law happens, Vladek's kicked out of university, and my Vladek is kicked out of university, gets his way to England to his family by going through Algeria, because he's an anthropologist, and he got a fake permission to go and do some anthropology work in Algeria, hightails it to England, is illegal in England, I suppose, for years, and then writes his degree at Cambridge. The guy doesn't speak a word of English, he speaks French. He refused to learn Russian because, you know, hates Russians. Learns French. He writes a doctorate in English in 3 years at Cambridge. I can, you know... That's my Vladek. I'm like,
wow. You know, super impressive.
I wish I could have that gift for language. Anyway, so that's what happens. And then we sort of hit it off, and I learned his father's history long after, you know. And I met his dad in 1986. He came to speak at Oxford. And it was a fascinating experience because he came to give a talk at the university. And he, you know, gave his talk and was talking about Poland and da da da. And he was a very affable, fun, very funny, witty, hilarious person, really fun. And we got along extremely well. I remember he gave a speech, and then he was sort of meeting and greeting sort of Polish people and stuff like that, and then the old professors and stuff. And then his face kind of went ashen white, and he put his arms down beside him, and he said, "Get that woman away from me." And I said, "What the hell?" And Vladek realized who it was. It was Madame Bruce, Mrs. Bruce, who was married. She had been had a different name. She'd been married to somebody else before. Turned out she was married to the chief prosecutor in Stalinist Poland, and she herself had become a prosecutor in Stalinist Poland. And she'd since married Professor Bruce, who was a very famous economist, went with him to Oxford and lived the life of a, you know, wonderful economics professor. Right. But she had been responsible. Every 2 months, he was taken from his prison cell, brought up to her office, and she signed on him going back to the prison cell every two months. There were two different phases of his incarceration, but this went on with her for about 4 years. And he was like, "This woman away from me," you know. It was just incredible. So this was my kind of first introduction.
You just couldn't make that up.
No, it was just unbelievable. So this was kind of the first meeting, at their official meeting at Oxford. But anyway, so his life was incredible, and
how absolutely amazing. I'm just absolutely gobsmacked by all this.
Yes,
and one of the questions that came up earlier, which I felt was really, really interesting, was this whole thing, and it does come up from time to time, and I feel really inadequately informed about how to answer. Is how much the Allies knew about Auschwitz and the death camps, and could they have done anything about it?
This is a really interesting question, a very, very complicated one, and I'm torn about this as well, because you read something and then you read something else and it completely contradicts what you think. That people say, "Why didn't the Germans do something?" Because they must have known about Auschwitz. And then, you know, I do a lot of work in Warsaw, and in particular the Jews from Warsaw, who perished in Treblinka. Treblinka was just an extermination camp north of Warsaw. It was the second highest death toll, around about 850,000 people. Because of Vladek's father and Vladek, I was incredibly fortunate to have met just so many amazing people. And one of them was Marek Edelman, who was the last head of the resistance, last resistance head in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. He survived. He later became a very famous heart surgeon in Poland. He stayed in Warsaw. And I remember talking to him about this very question, you know, how much do people know and so on. And he said that when the Großaktion first started happening, Operation Reinhardt, when they started to first empty the ghetto, people still really believed that they were going to be taken to something better, further east, work camps, because there was this argument, you know, why would they kill us off? We're you know, a good workforce or whatever. It doesn't make sense. It wasn't logical. So even the Jews within the ghetto were thinking, were sort of justifying that somehow everything was going to be okay. So they were taken on the trains. But then both the Polish Home Army and the Jewish underground and so on, they began to exchange information following the trains to Treblinka, realizing they were going full, coming back empty. There was no food ever going there and so on. And they began to put two and two together and realized that something terrible was going on.
And there was also people like, what's his name, Kurt Gerstein or whatever his name was?
Yeah, and there were a few people who
sort of told them, because he told the West, didn't he?
Yes, there were a few people who did. And
Gerstein, that was his name?
There was Weichel from Treblinka. But anyway, just to finish this, they realized that something terrible was happening. But Marek Edelman said, they started to try and kind of motivate the ghetto, in which there were about 440,000 people left to, you know, were part of this uprising, to try and motivate everybody in the ghetto to take part in the uprising, because they knew that, you know, they were going to be killed off in Treblinka. And the idea was, you're not really going to win against the German might of the Germans, but at least you die with a gun in your hand, at least you die resisting. And he said the Germans came to that because they were going to still doing the second phase of the Großaktion, of the roundups and the deportations to Treblinka, came with marmalade and bread, And Mark Edelman said we went around to people who were saying they're giving us marmalade and bread, and he'd say, don't get on the train, join us in the fight, come to the cellars or whatever. So even at that last, you know, that last moment, there were people who still believed. So even with the information, they didn't quite believe. And that tempers my view of the Western response, because it's a very, very complicated one. But there's a very famous situation where, first of all, you have Pilecki, who gets himself into Auschwitz and then out again. Later on, there are the two Slovaks who escape from Auschwitz-Birkenau, and they go and report in Hungary to the fact that that they were working on these ramps that the Hungarian Jews were going to be brought in and murdered on. They hear all of this stuff.
Right.
And this is absolutely 100% proof and evidence that this is going to happen. But Jan Karski...
Because the railway originally stopped about a mile
outside,
out.
Yeah, and they had to walk.
And it's, they rebuilt it. So the famous picture... Of the kind of entranceway at Birkenau with the railway going right through
that's
the arch.
That's very late.
That is made, I think, finished and completed in May 1944.
Absolutely, and it's
specifically
very late for the Hungarian Jews. Yeah, absolutely right. And so what happens is that they're starting to collect all this information. Jan Karski, who's another of the famous couriers who dresses up as a German and crosses Europe a few times, it's unbelievable, these people, gets himself into the Warsaw ghetto and also gets himself into a sub-camp of Chełmno, which is one of the big extermination camps, and sees what's going on, and then gets himself to the UK by this very incredible route, and goes to the Polish government in exile with this report, goes to and eventually ends up goes to Roosevelt and goes to the Chief Justice Felix Frankfurter.
Right, so they know.
Well, he goes to Roosevelt. Roosevelt doesn't even want to talk to him. He talks about horses, you know. Aren't there great horses in Poland? He just brushes them off.
Right.
And Felix Frankfurter, there's this very, very famous meeting, controversial meeting, when Karski goes into the office in Washington with the ambassador and Felix Frankfurter, and the ambassador says, you need to tell your story, and he does, and Felix Frankfurter paces up and down and gets all agitated. And then he says, it's not that I think you're lying. It's just that I don't believe you. And, you know, this is the problem, right? It's just so unbelievable that people couldn't grasp what was going on.
Yep.
So even when evidence...
Well, I can understand that, because, it is
unbelievable.
So hard to get your head around.
And
you can't imagine how it gets to this.
And the other thing is that I think what actually made it much more complex was exactly after the war. There were so many people said, well, the Germans must have known, and they had to go and line up and see the Bergen-Belsen, you know, piles of bodies at Dachau and so on. And all the Germans must have known. And yet this conflicts with the for example, the utter secrecy. And I know you've been to Auschwitz-Birkenau. Well,
everyone knew at all.
There were some young women, for example. There was some very, very interesting stuff has been published, in the last 20 years about this. Young women, for example, who were forced to work as sort of serving girls at the SS guys' houses that were just outside of the camp limits. And there was one case, for example, of a young girl who... There was a typhus scare in the camp and then in the village, and she was supposed to go and have a typhus shot. She was told to go into the main camp, Auschwitz I, but she got the day or the time wrong. She ended up going in. Somehow got herself in and was heading toward where she'd been told to meet whoever was going to give her the shot for typhus, and got in huge trouble because she'd gone inside the camp without an escort or whatever. Because even though she worked for the SS family and so on,
she wasn't supposed to see.
She wasn't supposed to know about it. They were so completely crazy about secrecy. That was the whole thing about when they closed down Treblinka and Chełmno and all these other places. Then they have this horrible action where they dig out all these bodies. You know, can you imagine 650,000 decomposing bodies that have to be cremated now?
So the Western allies have been given, you know, it has been brought to their attention.
Yes, yeah.
And the thing is, if you go around sort of bombing Auschwitz, you're going to kill lots of people anyway, aren't you?
Well, this is the question. I talked to a number of inmates, and my father-in-law also thought they should have bombed, and they should have just been all over the airwaves. You know, it just done, bring it
yes,
to
but,
attention.
But how does that going to look if you kind of sort of bomb this camp and destroyed it, but you've also killed all the inmates?
This is something you would know more about than I do, actually, because I was actually just reading something recently about a couple of interviews with... pilots who, for example, you know, when the shuttle mission was, because the Poltava base was blown up, then they started doing sort of quote-unquote shuttle mission, but with P-51s, with a bomb underneath, whatever else. You know, there was an argument that maybe you could get closer and you could just zoom in and drop some bombs and be quite accurate and then get out again. And those people who, well, I don't know, because I'm not the bomber guy, but there's a question of whether or not, even if you hadn't been accurate, the survivors that I've talked to, I'm thinking in particular of a most marvelous guy called Marian Turski, who's incredible, but many others who have asked this very question, and they say, we would have rather died in the bombing than being gassed or being just worked to death and so on. And the disruption, had they managed to, you know, it took 8 months to build those it was the gas chamber, it's not the crematoria that mattered, it was the actual gas chamber facility, and if they could have damaged that somehow, even give it a try, you know. And those people I've talked to, okay, it's not a representative sample, maybe many other people feel differently, but they said, we'd rather try. My father-in-law's argument was, try bring attention to it. Don't let the Nazis think they're going to get away with this, what they've done to Treblinka, what they've done to Helmut. And also he said that should have been on like the BBC, because everybody listened to the BBC who could get away with it. You know, we are naming and shaming you. You know,
and is there any reason why they don't do that? It's because they don't quite believe it.
They do it a little bit. I mean, toward the end there are. In fact, Marian Turski, who I mentioned, was in the Łódź ghetto. He was a young guy, and he works with a small group of underground people in the Łódź ghetto. They were socialists. They were left-wing. Right. And he, his job, because he spoke some English, was to write down the BBC messages secretly in the Łódź ghetto. And he did hear these BBC broadcasts, first of all, telling about the camps and so on. So they knew was happening. Yeah. So they knew.
God, it feels like there's more work to be done on all this.
Oh, yeah. It's just...
So why hasn't someone done it? Because it's such a hot potato.
It's a drop in the ocean. There's a huge amount of scholarship, huge amount of work going on now, but it only started in the 1980s. I mean, you know, before that, the real focus, as you well know, on World War II history was the guns and ammo stuff and Hitler and Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels, Goering and all that kind of stuff. And also, as you well know, the Nazi generals were very, very good at pretending that they'd had nothing to do with this, didn't have a clue, and all that.
Absolutely.
Something you know an awful lot about, too. You've read many of their, you know, these sort of very...
the lion swine.
Lion swine. And you know, and so yeah, it's starting to become... And the thing that my big thesis, and I'm certainly not unique or original in this, is to look at the whole of this. I mean, to me, the Holocaust, the mass murder, the treatment of my father-in-law, the killing of the Poles, the decapitation of Polish and then Soviet society, which was supposed to happen before the mass murder of the Jews and even before the mass murder of the Soviet, murder by starvation of the Soviet POWs, was the decapitation of society in Soviet Union. This was all to be part and parcel of these big war aims. So yes, you got the guns and ammo stuff, but the killing of these populations or the controlling of these populations is part of the war aim.
Right.
And that's what the German generals after the war pretended that wasn't the case.
Yes.
This is why I just have...
Well, there's the whole hunger plan, which is the Wehrmacht plan.
Exactly. So I don't have time for Rommel. I know a lot of people think he's so great. I just no time for the guy because he was right in there, right in it when it all started. And at the end, he sort of thinks Hitler's not running the war very well and maybe, you know, we can get rid of him and do something else. But I mean... I'm much more empathetic to him than most of the rest of them, but nevertheless, they're all gun-loaded.
They've all got blood on their hands. They're all up to their necks in it.
Yeah, and they're all ready to go kill, you know, Eric Bakzaleski, 12 million people the first winter. Oops, you know. I mean, by starvation, just ordinary people. Horrible. Unbelievable. So that's my next book.
That has been the most amazing hour. I'm absolutely... That has just been fantastic. Look, God, we've been talking for an hour. These podcasts are supposed to be half an hour.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, we've been talking for exactly 1 hour, but that is absolutely... That's just... That has been really, really incredible.
Well, cheers.
Really incredible. And
you're coming to Warsaw next.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, Al and I will hot foot it out at some point. Oh, that'd be amazing.
Fantastic, yeah. Brilliant.
Alex, thank you.